I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to Radio Times. In a few days, it will be Christmas Eve, time to get the family together to watch those traditional favorites. It's a Wonderful Life, White Christmas, How the Grinch Stole Christmas, Elf, Miracle on 34th Street, The Polar Express, or Die Hard. Guest Doogie Horner has watched Die Hard untold numbers of times and says it might be the perfect Christmas movie involving terrorists, lots of gunplay, car crashes, a high-rise under construction, and Bruce Willis as John McClane trying to get home to his children for Christmas. Doogie Horner reworked the poem A Visit from St. Nicholas to tell the Die Hard story for his new book, A Die Hard Christmas, the illustrated holiday classic. He's a comedian based here in Philadelphia, a writer, and joins us today on Radio Times to read from his new book, to talk about why Die Hard may be the perfect Christmas movie, and to reminisce about the time he won over a hostile audience and on America's Got Talent. Doogie Horner, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you here. Well, let's do what we always do on NPR, which is start with a reading when interviewing an author.
All right, here we go. All right. 'Twas the night before Christmas, and up in the tower, everyone was partying except one wallflower. John McClane missed his wife. Things just weren't the same since Holly had moved west and changed her last name. He tried to win her back, but still she said no, while unbeknownst to them, there was trouble below. A truck had pulled up, and who should disembark but 14 men whose intentions were dark. They spoke not a word and unloaded big crates. They cut the phone lines and locked all the gates. Carl swept the ground floor, shooting every guard dead, while visions of bearer bonds danced in his head.
Where did this idea come from?
It wasn't even my idea. I had done a Die Hard coloring book for HarperCollins. And
why?
Why? They asked me if I had any coloring book ideas. And, you know, at that time, I think there was that adult coloring book craze that lasted a week or two.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, I think people like doing these coloring books. It's a nostalgia thing, so we should do some for 80s movies. And I suggested Die Hard because it's one of my favorite movies. Mm-hmm. So I did the Die Hard coloring book. And then Insight, who's the publisher that did this, called me up and they said, hey, you're the Die Hard guy, right? do you want to do another one? So it was their idea, actually.
So you're the Die Hard guy. You're comfy with that?
Yeah, that's fine. It's better than being the Under Siege guy.
Exactly. So it's funny. I went online to find out, so why is Die Hard a Christmas movie? And there's some obvious things, which is it takes place during Christmas.
Yeah,
what else?
There's so many reasons. I didn't even know that there was a debate about whether or not it was a Christmas movie until I made this book and people told me about the debate. I mean, it happens at Christmas, but that doesn't make it a Christmas movie. I would say what makes it a Christmas movie, besides all the obvious things, it takes place at Christmas. It's the holiday party. There's Christmas lights. There's Christmas trees. There's Christmas music. It's about – the theme of the film is figuring out what's really important. It's not about presents. It's about family. And that's what John is trying to do in this movie. He's trying to get his family back together. And the terrorists, who are not actually terrorists, they're robbers. But
they feel like terrorists, though.
Yeah. Whoever said that we were terrorists, they're actually robbers. But so that storyline is actually not as important as John getting his family back together. And it just so happens the two plot lines dovetail.
And a really bad guy. I mean, I don't know if you always need that for a Christmas story, but certainly Alan Rickman is,
yeah,
what, Hans Gruber, right?
Yeah, and he's kind of like Scrooge or the Grinch, you know. He's like, I don't like Christmas, and I'm going to blow up this building. I don't know if that parallel works. But,
yeah.
But anyways, I think it's pretty clearly a Christmas movie. But I understand why people say it's not. It's just like, well, too many people die, which I get. After you played that sound clip of just like, ah, dear, ah! I was like, oh, okay. Well, when you say it like that, it doesn't sound like a Christmas movie.
But I read an interview with you, but you also say, you know, if you think about Home Alone, which could also, I mean, in many ways is a Christmas movie, here's a child that gets forgotten, A Wonderful Life, a banker who's contemplating suicide. So it's not like all Christmas movies have to have this sort of lovely underpinning.
No, Gremlins, similar. People also don't consider that a Christmas movie. I guess that's a bad example. But anyways, but yeah, I think Christmas is a heavy time for a lot of people, and it's the end of the year. It makes you think about your life, and it makes you reflect on what's truly important.
And have you gotten this debate going again with your Die Hard Christmas? And I think it's interesting that it's been out a month or so, and it's already a holiday classic. I mean, that's pretty good.
It's already a classic. It didn't take long.
But has this jump-started the debate over Die Hard as a Christmas movie?
Apparently the debate has been going on this whole time, because I've heard from so many people that write to me and they say, thank you. I argue with my family about this and they don't believe me that it's a Christmas movie. We have this debate every year. So apparently it's something that's been going on. The book didn't start the debate.
Well, let me give out the phone number in case people want to debate this issue on Radio Times. And it's 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Talking with Doogie Horner about Die Hard, the movie. There's now Die Hard, the Christmas book. And he took that poem that we all know, A Visit from St. Nicholas, or 'Twas the Night Before Christmas, to tell this Die Hard story. We had a short reading for you to get a flavor for the book. So do join our conversation. I'm curious about how many times you've watched Die Hard and what your first experience was.
You know, I don't even know how many times I've watched it. First of all, I'm bad at counting.
Are you? Truly?
I don't know how old I am. I never know what year it is. So I'm not sure how many times I've watched it. It's a lot. And I can't even remember the first time I watched it, because I was a kid at the time, and I'm sure it just came on, you know, I just saw it on
TV,
TBS or TNT or something, you know, like that. So I don't even remember. It's just always been part of my life.
Now, you were telling me before going in the air that you actually saw it in a movie theater at the Troc, right?
Yeah, recently.
Just a couple of days ago, having never seen this movie in a movie theater.
I never saw it on the big screen, and it was crazy. It was a fresh experience. You know, watching a movie with other people. I'm a big advocate of seeing, like, going out to movie theaters to see films. There's this group here in Philly, Exhumed Films, that shows old movies, and we always go to see them. Seeing a movie in the theater with other people, it's just a different experience. You hear where they laugh, you hear where they are quiet, and it's different. It's a group experience. Yeah. So the Troc showed it on Monday. South Street Cinema, I think, is showing it tonight if people are looking for another opportunity to see it on the big screen. I highly recommend it.
Can you lip sync along with the movie
if
you watch it that many times? You know all the lines?
Yeah. Yeah. My favorite line, which a lot of people don't
is
quote, is, "You're very fast, Argyle," when Bruce is in the limo with Argyle, the limo driver, and Argyle won't shut up. And Bruce says, "You're very fast, Argyle."
That's a good line.
I love that line.
Are there other Christmas movies you like?
I love
it. Or have watched maybe almost as obsessively?
I've watched It's a Wonderful Life as many times.
Really?
And I would actually say that's my favorite Christmas movie, not Die Hard. It just gets me. Every time I'm like, all right, this time I won't cry. And every time I cry like a baby. It's embarrassing in front of my whole family. Just poor John, or wait, George.
George.
Old mossback George. I just feel so bad for him. Poor guy.
But it works, right?
Yeah, it's a great movie. It's fantastic.
Let's talk a little bit about your comedy career, I guess growing up in comedy, or how you discover comedy. Were you a funny kid?
I was a weird kid. I was extremely unpopular.
Truly?
Yeah, truly. I did not get along with other kids. I guess I was funny. I mean, I was weird. All the kids called me weird.
In that kind of nerdy, weirdy way?
I guess so. I think that was actually really good. I don't think I ever would have done comedy if I'd been popular as a kid, because I think a lot of people, the reason they don't want to do comedy, well, there's lots of reasons. First of all, it's not a good job, but
it's hard, right?
They don't want to do it because, like, you're like, well, if I get up on stage and I embarrass myself. But I had been embarrassed so many times already, that didn't hold any fear for me. So I think it was actually really good. It seems like a lot of comedians don't really fit in. And so they sort of learn not to respect social norms and not to worry about it. Like, if everybody's – and it helps to have, like, an unusual viewpoint.
Yeah. What would you say yours is?
I don't know. I don't know. I just know all the time. It actually bothers me. A lot of times I'll say something and I'm not trying to be funny and people laugh at me. I'm like, what? I wasn't a joke. I was serious.
Well, I'm thinking about that, I guess, what, loner kid? I mean, loner kids often become writer. I mean, they often become creative people because they watch other people.
Mm-hmm.
Was that true for you?
Yeah. Yeah, I was a choir kid. I read a lot. Just bored by reality.
Right.
I don't know.
But at one point, you must have said, you know, I'm going to try comedy. What was that?
Well, it was pretty late. It was when I was, I don't remember how long ago it was. Like I said, I don't count. But it was, I was already an adult. I was here in Philly. At that time, I was playing table tennis a lot. And
for money or just
no,
for fun?
No, just for fun. Yeah, I was a hustler. I was a table tennis hustler. I was very wealthy. And I was an artist. I drew and I wrote and I was making movies. But those were all sort of very solitary pursuits. And I wanted to do something else that got me out of the house. And so Helium Comedy Club had just opened up recently and somebody told me there was an open mic. And so I went and tried it.
Really?
And I loved it.
What did you love? And was it a kind of love at first sight? Or I mean, that first time you went on the stage and told jokes?
Yeah,
and told
absolutely.
Stories?
I like that you can just think of something and then say it. When you write a book, you can sell a lot of copies and a lot of people read it, but then you don't know if they liked it or not. Or like maybe people will tell you. But like if you do a comedy show, even if there's only 10 people there, you know those 10 people heard you. Even if they don't like what you said. They're like, I hate you. You ruined my date. You know, you're like, well, you heard my thought. And so I like that instant feedback. You can just think of something and say it. You can work on it all day.
Mm-hmm.
Like while you're in line at the grocery store or whatever, you can be thinking about jokes. You don't have to be sitting at a computer or sitting at a desk.
And is that how you work? I mean, which is it all mapped out or are you willing to kind of go with what happens?
I write it down, but then I also think about it and then I do a little bit of a mix of both. You know, you write it down, you think about it, and then when you go it on stage, I try to like think about it, memorize it, forget it, get back on stage, and then retell it from my memory so that it
sounds fresh to you.
Yeah, and so it's more like how would I actually say it to you as opposed to like me just reciting a thing I have memorized.
You get nervous or sort of is nervous slash excited? Sometimes those two things can feel the same.
I don't get nervous anymore, only if it's like a certain show. My friend Seth has this show in New York called Sweet, and he hosts it by sitting on the side of the stage and staring at you your whole set. And I always get nervous then, or like if there's a comedian I really respect in the room. Like I work with Todd Barry a lot, and sometimes if I'm doing my set and I see him walk into the back of the room and stare and watch my set, then I'll get nervous. But usually I don't anymore.
Let's take a very short break. An email from Pamela. Don't forget, a lot of people died in the biblical Christmas story, too, specifically the babies and toddlers of Bethlehem, Matthew 2:16-18.
Oh, geez.
Talking with Doogie Horner about Die Hard Christmas and his comedy career. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscone. I'm talking with Doogie Horner about his new book, Die Hard Christmas, an illustrated holiday classic, or I should say the illustrated holiday classic. He's a comedian based here in Philadelphia, and he was on America's Got Talent back in 2010. It didn't start out well, but let's listen to it and see how it ended up.
I don't trust pregnant people. I feel like they're hiding something. You guys already? I haven't even started.
This crowd is just tired. They're over it.
Everything I know I learned on the streets, except breakdancing, which I learned at summer Bible camp. My friend asked me, he said, if you could be any animal, what animal would you choose to be? And I said, an eagle. And he said, why? So you could fly? And I said, no, so I could finally have sex with eagles.
I love that.
Have you guys heard about the rising? When I tell people I'm famous, nobody believes me. I'm unbelievably famous. You are terrible people. What's the matter with you? I have jokes I'm going to tell. No, forget it. I'm out of here. I'm going to confound you people. I'm going to hunt you down like bugs. I'm going to squish you in your houses. This a funny hairdo. What's going on with your facial hair? You got a problem, buddy? I like you. I hate you. I like you. I hate you. I like you. You're cool. You guys are cool. You suck. Go home. You're great. This judge thinks I suck. I can see why. I'm going to lose my voice in 3 seconds.
Oh, I haven't heard
I
that
was
in a
watching
while.
You listen to yourself. I don't know. Was that imploding on stage? Although you, I can't tell if they were saying yay because you
they were
about
not saying yay. Near the end, then
near
people,
the end,
near
I
the
heard
end,
a couple.
People started to cheer. Half right. the crowd started to cheer because people love it when you tell them off.
is that what it was?
I think they liked it that people like it when you stand up for yourself. It's weird. When people watch reality television, you want two things. You want to see people fail, first of all, because you want to feel better about all the times you didn't try to do something, right? A lot of people on reality television, they're going out on a limb. They're like, I think I'm a great dancer. And then they go up and they're like, you can't dance. And it makes you feel better about that time when you didn't go to dance school. Instead, you went to business college.
But and then, you still can't dance.
Yeah.
Right.
At the same time, you want to see people succeed. So it's weird. So like people were booing me at first because they're like, you're not
funny.
Did
you expect
that,
by the way?
I expected it not to go well. I didn't expect it to go that bad. I screened the F word because they buzzed me. And they told you, they're like, if we buzz you, just keep going. But they didn't tell you how loud the buzzer was going to be. And it scared me. And I went, ah! They were like, don't, if you hear the buzzer, just keep going. And also, don't curse. And I did the two things back to back. But I mean, at that point, I was used to being booed. I got booed many, many times. I still get heckled all the time. I don't know why.
Mm-hmm.
I seem to get heckled more than most mm-hmm. people. And so I wasn't exactly surprised, but I didn't think it was going to go that bad. But
is
I knew
it, kind
it wasn't
going to
go well.
A badge? I mean, that went viral. We just played it. It's, what, 7 years old, and it
yeah.
still lives on, right?
Yeah.
Is it kind of a badge for you? This happened to me on America's Got Talent?
Yeah, it was a fun experience. I don't want to be one of those people that – there are these videos that's like, comedian destroys heckler. I don't want to propagate the idea that that's a great relationship, this idea that it's fun to be adversarial, that it's fun to make fun of people. I don't right. actually like to do that. I don't think that's the point of comedy, however.
But there you were.
But however, having said that,
audience, right.
if you heckle me, I will yell at your face. I will do it.
We got some diehard comments, questions here. We've got Becky from Glen Mills. Becky, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
I just want to let you know that I love your show.
Thank you.
I am 38 years old, and I had never seen Die Hard. I heard this debate going on, and I watched it last night, and I definitely agree that it is a Christmas movie.
Wow. And based on what criteria, Becky?
Well, I didn't have any criteria going into it, but I liked that at first, I think when the movie is early on, he's whistling Christmas tunes.
Right.
And I thought, yeah, of course, this is definitely
it's Christmas. And that was enough for you, right, Becky?
It was.
Well, there's one for you.
Thank Doogie. You, Becky.
Thank you, Becky, for calling in. An email from Mark. Did you like or do you like Die Hard 2? Will there be a Christmas sequel poem?
I don't know if we're going to do Die Hard 2. We discussed it. I like Die Hard 2. I don't like it as much as Die Hard 1. I will say 1 and 2 are the only two films I consider Die Hard movies.
Right.
I think the rest are so different in format. They're more just like action movies with Bruce Willis in them. His character just becomes so superhuman. They change locations too much. The third movie is really more like a Lethal Weapon movie. The script was actually supposed to be a Lethal Weapon script. Uh-huh. And when you view it like that, it makes a lot more sense.
An email from Matt. Are there any parallels between Die Hard plot and the actual Christmas story as told in the Bible? I have no agenda. I'm just asking this out of naked curiosity.
I don't know. I never thought about that before. I'm going to say not many. Maybe not so much. But I don't know. I never thought about it before. It's a good point.
Yeah. An email from Rick, who seems like he might know the answer to this. Ask Doogie about the connection between action movies and European painting styles.
Oh.
Obviously a leading question here.
Yeah, they're heavy. He's probably seen my talk. I have a talk I give about the parallels between the development of visual art in Italy during the Renaissance and the development of American action films. And the Die Hard is the Mona Lisa. It's this perfect balance of mostly reality with a little dash of animation.
Right.
But then action movies after that were like, oh, look how good stuff gets when we add a little bit of fantasy. And so they add more fantasy and you end up with Con Air, which is like mannerism, which is the art period that came after the High Renaissance. And then you got
I'd taken this class in college.
Yeah, this
I'm
is
just
not
saying.
A class. If anybody would like to make it a college class, please contact me. But yeah, it's a long theory I have that people seem to agree with. I don't, but it's just a theory.
We're going to end with another reading, and you have some really fascinating names of trees.
Oh, yeah. I made a list of pretentious tree names for McSweeney's. Would you like me to read it?
I would.
Okay. Chester Log Snobwood, Olive Linseed Split Shingles, Nedwin Linwood, Crosby Aspen Bird Nest, Downing Sapling Phelps, Miles Twigston Hill, Noble Surfer Ellingswood, Ashton Fir Mapleheart, Hickory Mockernut, Elijah Wood, Leaf Barkmont III, Walden Holt Larch, Newberry Fir, Holly Stem Turnbluth, and Benson Loblolly Pine.
Those sound like names you might find in the Social Register. I'm
right?
Just saying.
But they're all trees, too. Willoughby Yew, Digby Applewood. Anyways, it's longer, but it's so long. If I read the whole thing, you'd be like, we get it.
We got to get out of here.
They're pretentious trees.
Well, on that note, Doogie Horner, thank you so much for coming in and joining us on Radio Times.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And he does have a new book, The Die Hard Christmas, the Illustrated Holiday Classic. Also had a book that came out just a while ago called Some Very Interesting Cats Perhaps You Weren't Aware Of. And we do want to close things out with the song that was played at the very end of Die Hard. It's Vaughn Monroe's 1945 rendition of Let It Snow, featured in Die Hard as the credits close.
Oh, the weather outside is frightful, but the fire is so delightful. And since we've no place to go, let it snow, let it snow, let it snow. It doesn't show signs of stopping, and I've bought some corn for popping. The lights are turned way down low. Let it snow, let it snow, let it snow. When we finally kiss goodnight.
Well, this is a weird segue on Radio Times. Trump supporters claim that special counsel Robert Mueller and the FBI are intent on destroying the president. Here's Fox's Jesse Waters earlier this week.
So the investigation into Donald Trump's campaign has been crooked from the jump. But the scary part is we may now have proof the investigation was weaponized to destroy his presidency for partisan political purposes and to disenfranchise millions of American voters. Now, if that's true, we have a coup on our hands in America.
Senator Mark Warner, Democrat from Virginia, said on Wednesday that any attempt to fire Mueller was reckless, inappropriate, and extremely worrying, and it could lead to a constitutional crisis. Representative Maxine Waters, Democrat from California, reinforced that message yesterday on MSNBC's All In with Chris Hayes.
Well, I think any action that's taken by this president to impede or interfere with this investigation will not be received very well by the members of Congress or by the citizens of this country. So the firing of Rosenstein, the firing of Special Counsel Mueller, any of that is going to get a reaction because we know that this is the worst way that this president can use his power to undermine the rule of law. It is unusual. It is extraordinary. And we just believe that we cannot allow this kind of constitutional crisis to take place without responding to it.
Well, today on the show, the showdown over the Mueller investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election and possible collusion by the Trump campaign, how it's playing out in the United States, and a little bit later, how it's playing out in Russia. David Korn joins us. He's Washington Bureau Chief for Mother Jones. His books include Showdown and Hubris. David Korn, it's been a couple of years. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Oh, good to be with you. Good transition from Die Hard.
I didn't exactly know how to get from point A to point B, but here we are. Are Robert Mueller's days numbered, or are we just watching some form of political theater, or both?
Well, you are seeing political theater coming from the Republican side, and I hate to sound partisan, but, you know, Robert Mueller is not a Democrat. He is actually a Republican, as was the fellow who appointed him, Rod Rosenstein. And what's sad to see is on an issue in which we should have bipartisan support here in Washington and across the nation, examining what happened when this country was attacked by a foreign adversary targeting one of the bedrocks of our nation, our election system. Instead, we see Republicans doing everything they can to try to shut down and close off early investigations on the Hill and then undermine this special counsel investigation, which began as a counterintelligence investigation under Jim Comey at the FBI, who is another Republican. So it's really quite, I think, disheartening for anybody who cares about good government and also the national security of the United States to watch Republicans put, you know, partisan or political priorities first out there trying to protect the president and people around him from any criticism and from, you know, aiding or abetting or helping or colluding, whatever may or may not have happened, with this attack on the United States.
Do you think it's a sign, and, you know, I'm asking you to get into, I guess, Mueller's head or his investigation, and he's been very tight-lipped about it, but do you think there's a sign that Mueller is on to something? I believe there's a meeting today at the White House with some of Trump's lawyers and I believe people from Mueller's team, but do you think we're at that something is coming?
Well, my guess is, you know, he's only been at this less than a year. Investigations of this nature often take several years. The independent counsel in the Watergate, in the Iran-Contra case, didn't bring charges and cases until years after he'd started investigating. So this whole idea that he's even closing in on something may be misguided. He may be in the middle of an investigation and still following different trails. I mean, there's a lot to look at here, whether it's, you know, direct collusion possibility, I'll say, of direct collusion between the campaign and Russia, looking at other things that come up in the course of that investigation, which could be financial misdeeds, as we saw in the case of Paul Manafort. And that obviously there are other people in Trump's orbit who could come under that type of scrutiny. I mean, it's a really difficult investigations, particularly if they involve international banking records or communications. So, I mean, I wouldn't say that anything's like coming to a head in the next couple of weeks here. I think this is a long, you know, investigation that takes a lot of patience. And the only question is, to what degree Republicans in Congress and, you know, even in the White House will try to intervene or, you know, or block it or at least to delegitimize it.
Well, not to get ahead of the story here, but the president, if he wanted to fire Mueller, he can't, right? He has to go through Rosenstein.
Yes, he has to. He could order Rosenstein to do it. And if Rosenstein said no, the president could either accept that or he could fire Rosenstein, and the next person to move up into that position, he could demand that he or she fire and keep going on and on until you find somebody that, you know, that's willing to do it. That's kind of what happened with Watergate when Richard Nixon ordered the attorney general to fire the special prosecutor. He said no, and eventually it was Robert Bork, who became famous for other reasons, who took the job on and who issued the order to fire him. So, yes, I mean, I imagine that eventually he would find somebody to do it, but he might, have to hollow out the top ranks of the Justice Department to get that done. But also, you know, I'm not out there saying, there are people out there saying that they think it's imminent that, you know, Trump is going to do this, that he's conspiring to do this. I don't know if that's the case at all. I think it's pointless speculation. I think it's interesting to sort of look at what's possible, given his attacks on the FBI and what he did with Jim Comey. But I do think it would be a complete, you know, constitutional crisis, probably even more serious than Watergate. Should he do that? Remember, with Watergate, we were, you know, the President Nixon was trying to cover up what were really kind of petty, you know, crimes in terms of break-ins, and I don't know, not great, quite petty, but they were, you know, break-ins and money issues in terms of campaign financing. What's at the core of this investigation is an attack. I mean, it's information warfare. Mm-hmm. It's not with guns and bullets, but it was an attack on the United States from a foreign adversary that wanted to influence an election and benefited the person in office now. And he has done everything possible, Donald Trump, to not look at this, to not do anything to prevent it from happening again, to deny it even occurred. This is, in that way, since this gets to the bedrock of our principle of our nation, elections that determine who run the government, that I think it's far more serious and the implications are far deeper and wider than what we had during Watergate.
And we're almost having a break here. You crystallized the story. Do you find this a hard story to keep track of?
Yes. There's just a lot of different angles. And whether it's looking at what the campaign did, whether it's looking at what happened after the campaign, whether there's obstruction of justice committed by Donald Trump in the White House and trying to block these investigations. Michael Flynn, who has pled guilty to lying to the FBI, is involved in like five different sub-scandals of his own, involving what work he did for Turkey, whether he lied about talking to the Russian ambassador, and being involved with a project to put nuclear plants in the Middle East, and lobbying about that while he was about to be National Security Advisor. There's a lot to cover here.
And that's David Korn, Washington Bureau Chief for Mother Jones. Julia Iafi waiting in the wings. She's staff writer for The Atlantic. Catching up on the week's worth of news over the Mueller investigation, how it's playing in the U.S. and Russia. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, talking about the Mueller investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election, possible collusion by the Trump campaign. And again, David Korn, Washington Bureau Chief for Mother Jones, joining us. And joining us now is Julia Iafi, and she's a staff writer for The Atlantic. And Julia, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. I was talking with David and our listeners about just what has been happening in Congress over the last couple of days. And let me put to you, because you wrote a piece recently in The Atlantic titled What Putin Really Wants. Does he want, and was the purpose of whatever Russia did to create kind of chaos and finger pointing and infighting and a kind of chaos in the United States? Do you think that was his goal?
I think that was...
Oh, that is not a good phone line. We're going to try to...
Oh, sorry. Let me try it like this. One second.
Okay.
I think that's his better. Goal was to interfere in some way in Hillary Clinton's election. He thought that she was the worst possible candidate to deal with if she became president of the United States, that she would not repeal sanctions, that she would... continue being tough on Russia, that she would be a continuation of the Obama president's administration's approach to Russia, which she was going to be, probably would be even tougher. You had Donald Trump talking about respect for Putin, pulling America off the world stage and thereby creating more room for Russia on the world stage. And you have to remember that the Russians weren't just in for Donald Trump. They were in for anybody who wasn't Hillary Clinton. They were publicly supporting Jill Stein. Bernie Sanders got a lot of play on Russia Today and domestic Russian media. There were attempts to reach out to the Jeb Bush campaign. So it was really just anybody who wasn't Hillary Clinton.
Well, they got Donald Trump. Do you think Putin and his allies are pleased with the outcome?
I think they're not. I think they're extremely unhappy because U.S.-Russia relations have never been this bad since the end of the Cold War. They weren't even this bad under the Obama administration, which Putin chafed so badly. They are extremely unhappy with how this turned out. Things got even worse for them because they interfered. So their interference backfired massively for them. They not only didn't get sanctions repealed, they are now baked in for a generation because Congress was so alarmed at the interference that they took away Trump's unilateral ability to repeal them. Not only did they not get back two compounds that the Obama administration seized from them at the end of last year, they got three more taken from them. They got even more diplomats kicked out. There are now FSB, high-ranking FSB officials on the FBI's cyber most wanted list when they used to be very close partners on the counterterrorism beat. So, and now the most unpredictable president in the world is no longer Vladimir Putin, it's Trump. Mm. And I was in Moscow in early April this year when Donald Trump ordered an air attack on a Syrian airfield after a chemical weapons attack. And the Russians were so taken aback. It had been, 2.5 months since he had been sworn in, and people close to the Russian foreign ministry were saying, you know, maybe Hillary Clinton would have been better for us. She's at least predictable. This guy is insane.
Well, that's it. Julia, hold on one second. Let me give David Corn just a chance to respond to that. That is such a I would say, interesting but also different perspective of coming out of Russia. How do you see it?
Well, I do think that the Russians did have an affinity for Donald Trump. I don't disagree with what Julia says, and it's an honor to be on with her, about trying to block Hillary Clinton. I believe they want to do that, too. I believe they saw this, and I think the U.S. intelligence community has come to this conclusion, as a threefer. They could block Hillary, revenge for her giving Putin a hard time about election irregularities back when she was Secretary of State in 2011, they could really mess things up here and show that elections aren't that great in democratic countries because we're always giving them a hard time about their absence of democracy. If they can discredit democracy here and elsewhere in other Western European nations, it helps them out. Mm-hmm. And I do think that at the time, they thought, here's a guy talking about getting rid of sanctions, keeps saying what a great guy Putin is. Well, he'd be much easier to deal with, and he may even actually help us get things done that we want to get done. So I think it was a bunch of factors. But I also agree, from early on, maybe even before the election day itself, there was some second thoughts happening within the Kremlin about the wisdom of doing this and getting behind Donald Trump. Mm. And there's been some dismay ever since that it makes it harder for them to have, if not a positive relationship with the United States, at least a stable one.
Well, Julia, let me read something that you wrote in The Atlantic. The subversion of the election, this is the American election, was as much a product of improvisation and entropy as it was of long-range vision. What makes Putin effective, what makes him dangerous, is not strategic brilliance, but a tactical flexibility and adaptability, a willingness to experiment, to disrupt, and to take big risks. Do you think we in the United States overestimate Putin's wiliness?
Absolutely. I don't think we overestimate his wiliness, but his capabilities, and B, his strategic long-term vision. If he was so omniscient, wouldn't he have understood that, you know, if he were caught, this is what would happen, and if he elected somebody as unpredictable and mercurial as Donald Trump, this is what would happen? He has a long track record of doing something very bold and audacious, where the consequences of that move seem to take him completely by surprise. And then he has to do another crazy thing to deal with the blowback from that thing.
Is he dangerous, though? I mean, how dangerous do you see him?
I think he's somebody who's unpredictable and who will go to great lengths to stay in power. I just don't think it makes him unique in that way. I think there's a lot of, you know, authoritarian leaders who just want to stay in power and, for understandable reasons, think the U.S. is coming after them to remove them from power under the guise of democracy promotion. So I think when people feel really threatened, they do crazy things. I think what's really dangerous is for us to not understand what we're dealing with and to make him out to be this genius, this brilliant tactical or strategic genius, which he's not, and to not really understand what's going on, to act like Russia and Putin are just completely mysterious and impossible to understand, and how can we ever know what's going on in his mind? He pretty much says what he wants and what he means. And it's not that hard to divine what he wants for Russia, and what he wants vis-a-vis the U.S.
Would that be saying?
And I think it's about time we listen up.
Well, David, do you think the same could be said for President Trump?
I think Vladimir Putin is far wilier and more knowledgeable than Donald Trump, and probably less impulsive. He obviously has an agenda, and he's been very clear about what he wants to do in terms of, you know, reviving his version of the Soviet or former, you know, Great Russian Empire. And he, you know, sees the United States as an obstacle to that and as a threat perhaps to his stability within power. So I think in some ways, you know, he was, you know, I'm not sure it was audacious. I'm not sure it was reckless what he did in the campaign, because he ended up still, for all the problems he may have with the United States now, he ended up with a president of the United States who seems pretty uninterested in boxing Putin in and responding to what he did to us or what he's doing to other countries, and is giving him a tremendous amount of free rein. I think Trump has been a bit clumsy about this, and because it's been so obvious that he's been gotten the better of by Putin, he now is boxed in and can't do some of the policy matters that he probably wanted to do, such as getting rid of sanctions and other things like that. So it's become, you know, a complicated, if not awkward, situation. But I don't think Putin stumbled into it. I mean, I think he was trying to, you know, at least get some chaos here, and then probably thought, well, you know, that would help him, and he'd figure out how to deal with that down the road.
Julia, and David as well, and I'm probably asking you to understand something that just certainly confounds me, and I think a lot of other people, which is why candidate Trump and now President Trump really refuses to utter a critical word about Vladimir Putin. And Juliet, since you know Russia better than most people and have some feel for Vladimir Putin, how do you see that?
From Trump's perspective or Putin's perspective?
Well, maybe from Putin's perspective, but just as someone, as an observer of what's been happening in these two countries and their leaders.
So, you know, I think from Trump's perspective, it's, you know, it goes with his affinity for authoritarian strongmen that he clearly, you know, admires and wants to be like. So I don't think Putin is his affection or regard for Putin is unique in that regard. He seems to regard Erdogan of Turkey very well. He seems to regard Xi of China, very highly. Same with Duterte of the Philippines, these very autocratic leaders. He seems to think that is kind of the apogee of executive presidential power, and that's clearly what he's striving for, at home. I think from Putin's perspective, I think it has probably evolved. I think originally, from his perspective, it was music to his ears, right? Here's a president or a presidential candidate in the U.S. who's talking about Putin in the reverential terms he has long craved to hear from the United States, and talking about respecting Russia as a great power, as opposed to Obama, who purposely derided Russia as a regional power, which drove Putin to distraction. But now I think there's a lot of frustration in Moscow that those guys all talk. You know, he talks about, you know, how lovely Putin is, but he can't do anything to help him. The narrative in Russia is that Trump's hands are tied by the national security and foreign policy establishments who so hate Russia, as opposed to this is what happened because you meddled in our elections and you got caught.
Well, that's interesting. David, I know you want to add something. Go ahead.
I would just say one thing to Trump's affinity for Putin and other repressive leaders. Part of it comes from business. He has tried for decades to get a building, a tower built in Moscow. He has interest in the Philippines and in Turkey. And so even during the campaign, during the campaign, while he was running for president, his office was still trying to negotiate a deal to build a mega tower in Moscow. Now, the way government works in Russia, it's not surprising, is you can't do that without government permission. And so do you think you could build a multi-million-dollar project in Moscow while you're attacking or saying anything critical about Vladimir Putin? Of course not. So he has put his business interests ahead of any ideas about policy or personal connections to Putin as well. You can't discount that.
Julie, you want to add something? Go ahead.
Yes, I've actually done extensive reporting about Trump's efforts to build something in Moscow. And Trump has been talking about this for 30 years. And after 30 years of talk and efforts and exploration in Moscow, there are exactly zero Trump buildings in Moscow or anywhere else in Russia. Meanwhile, every hotel chain, big or small, has an outpost in Russia, in Moscow, in St. Petersburg, and various other cities. The W, the Four Seasons, Hilton, Marriott, you name it. Radisson, they're all there except for Trump. So, and one of the reasons is that the Russians didn't know the Trump name from Adam, and they didn't feel like paying through the nose for this brand that didn't mean anything to them. And because Trump's go-between, who was trying to secure permission and secure a local partner to build something in Moscow, was too shady even for the Russians, and actually had... It didn't have any political connections to speak of. So, you know, with all due respect to David, the reporting and the facts kind of point in a different direction.
No, my only point is that he wanted to do this. This was a goal of his. And so if that's his goal, including while he's running for president, he is not going to be dumping on Putin while he is at the same time trying to get something business-wise going in Moscow. That's my point.
And we have about a minute here. I know we could go on, and it's actually quite fascinating. Let me ask you, though, David Cornyn. I don't have time to play a clip from earlier this week, but there was a real celebration at the White House, the passage of the tax bill. Orrin Hatch saying to the president, "You are living up to everything I thought you would. You're one heck of a leader. We're all benefiting from it. You may be the best president in U.S. history." Of course, you know, looking into the future. What did you make of that gathering? We have about 30 seconds, and I apologize.
You know, I felt like I woke up and I was living in North Korea. I mean, and I couldn't even get through the four-minute-long tribute that Mike Pence paid the president. You know, our elected leaders are, we don't pick kings, we don't pick deal leaders, and we treat them as if they're like, you know, peers, but not in the Trump cabinet, not in the Trump White House. You have to show adulation for him. Otherwise, you're out. And it's a sad thing to see this happen to the Republican Party.
Well, on that note, we'd love to have the two of you back together again to carry on this conversation.
Merry Christmas, everybody.
And Merry Christmas to you as well. David Cornyn, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Washington Bureau Chief for Mother Jones and Julia Iafi, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. She's staff writer for The Atlantic. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. Adam Stanishevsky, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us, and Merry Christmas.